Christina Kay here, and I'm so thrilled to be back on air with you, bringing you episode 51, which just so happens to be the very first episode of season 2 for 2021. Wow, I mean, what a year we had in 2020, am I right? But rather than dwelling on the past and all that negativity, let's focus on the future instead. And here at Write Your Best Book, we are thrilled with just some of the amazing new projects we're bringing you this year. Some of them I can't share with you just yet until the ink dries. But here are just a few of the fun, exciting, and helpful things we have planned for all authors in 2021. So we're restyling and relaunching our very first writing digital course, hopefully in early March. And to get you guys all amped up and excited for that launch, we're also hosting a 5-day Facebook challenge very soon. Guys, if you've never participated in a Facebook challenge, oh my God, be prepared, y'all. They're totally awesomely fun. All right. We're also launching our second digital writing course, How to Write Killer Suspense, on a hugely popular, but one I can't name yet, website at the end of January. We'll do something simple but fun leading up to that one. Also, I'm adding tons more downloadable resources for authors, both to our website and our Etsy shop. By the way, if you haven't checked out our Etsy shop yet, at Write Your Best Book. Okay, and finally, I'm working on several mini courses on very specific writing topics that authors everywhere struggle with daily. And each course will take, say, less than an hour to complete, and they'll sell for like $50 each. As I said, that's just a short list of some of our amazing new activities shaping up for 2021. Just imagine what I can't tell you about just yet and how freaking awesome that's gonna be. And since I don't want a single one of you to miss any of these amazing opportunities, be sure you're following us on social media. It's always on every channel. It's at Write Your Best Book. Follow our weekly blog, sign up for our newsletter, and make sure you have subscribed to this podcast. Links for all these things are always in the show notes. Now, speaking of podcasts, I do have one more really fun announcement for you guys regarding changes in 2021. Last year, as you know, on each podcast episode, we featured a really big, well-known influencer slash expert in the writing community. We had Jeff Goings, Derek Murphy, Jane Friedman, Dave Chesson, Jerry B. Jenkins. Heck, there were 50 of them. Well, guys, I was starting to run out of experts to interview, so I had to think of a new focus for season 2. It bothered me and it worried me for days, and then finally it came to me. This season, we're shifting gears only slightly, and each week I'm sitting down with a well-known best-selling author to discuss common pain points for all authors and how this guest host overcame that pain point in their own writing journey and went on to become a famous and successful author. And for the very first episode of the season, we have an amazing first guest host. Her name is Jennifer Robson, author of several historical novels set in World War I, World War II, including The Gown, Good Night from London, Midnight Over Paris, and so many more. She and I sat down recently to talk about something that I actually get asked quite often, which is how to write entertaining historical fiction and still remain accurate. We also discussed whether you can or should write about real-life people in history, and several other questions I just had to pick her brains about. A lifelong history nerd and academic, she studied French literature and modern history in undergrad. Then she received her doctorate from Oxford. Oxford. She went, she eventually worked as an editor for a while, but was eventually able to settle, oh, lucky gal, as a full-time writer. And we're also lucky she did. I'll let Jennifer tell you more about herself. So without further ado, I give you author Jennifer Robson. All right, guys, we are back on Write Your Best Book, the podcast. And as promised, we have author Jennifer Robson here in the studio. And we're going to talk about writing accurate but entertaining historical fiction. So welcome, Jennifer. Thank you so much for joining us on our podcast. I'm so excited to have this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. I cannot wait. So let's start by having you tell my listeners a bit more about you, your writing journey, your books, or anything else that you want them to know about you.
Absolutely. Well, I came to writing in not the typical way. I don't have a degree in creative writing. I didn't take English in college. I never imagined that I would be writing fiction when I was growing up and going to school. I actually trained as a historian. I thought I would end up teaching history at college. So I have an undergraduate degree in history and French literature. And then for my graduate degree, I went to Oxford in the UK, and I have a PhD, although in at Oxford, just to be different, and because they can, I guess, it's a DPhil. So I have a DPhil in modern history. And I assumed I would just become a historian. My father is a history professor, retired now, and I thought I would do what he did. Except that when I finished my degree in the mid-1990s, there really weren't any jobs available in North America or the UK for people teaching British history. And there still are very few. And so I pivoted. What else can you do? And I worked as a journalist for a number of years and an editor. And then my son was born in 2004 and his sister in 2007. And so I stayed home with them and worked as a freelancer. And just freelance editor, really anybody who needed help making their writing reasonably clear and understandable would come to me. And it was interesting. My heart wasn't really in it, to be honest. And so when my daughter was a newborn, so this was the spring of 2007, and my son was a very busy little toddler. And I loved being at home with them. I have no regrets. I loved it. It was a privilege to be at home with them. But there are long stretches. I don't think we talk about this enough. There are long stretches when you're at home with little kids, when, you know, it can get a little boring and a little bit lonely at times. I had wonderful friends who are also staying at home with their kids and so on, but there were still moments where I thought I just wanted to do something. I didn't want to go back to work as such. I just wanted to do something. And I'd had this idea, it just kind of right lurking in the back of my thoughts, you know, where I'd be aware of it occasionally, but I never did anything about it. I had an idea for years that I wanted to write a novel about the First World War, but it was from the woman's perspective. I wanted to know what it was like to be a woman and to be caught up in that terrible war. And so I started just very slowly writing in a notebook when the baby was sleeping. And I just kept at it for the better part of 2 years until I had a manuscript. I'd edited fiction before. I knew how to write a book, even though I had never done it. Well, apart from my terribly boring doctoral thesis, which is not the stuff of bestsellers, let me tell you. And I didn't really tell anyone in the beginning. I told my sister, but I didn't tell my husband at first because I wanted almost to surprise him with something that was complete. And I knew, you know, the process by which you go and, you know, you submit your manuscript, you pitch it to literary agents, there never was a time where you could freely send manuscripts to editors at the big publishing houses. That's just never been the route to getting a book published. And I approached a number of literary agents and nobody was really interested, bearing in mind this is 2009. Nobody was really that interested in publishing books about the First World War as historical fiction. And so I gave up for a little while. And then I guess it would have been in about I'm hazy on the dates now, but I think 2011, 2012, early 2012, where Downton Abbey came out. It debuted initially in England and I was hearing about it, and then it hit PBS in the States and just turned into this thing, right? It just took over. It was everywhere. And I still wasn't going to do anything about it. And then one of my closest friends who had read the book and loved it and was convinced that it should be published started a kind of calling and texting and saying, Jen, like, resubmit it. What do you have to lose? Yeah. Well, my pride actually is what I had to lose. I was so convinced I was going to be turned down multiple times again, but I did resubmit it to a kind of a new group of literary agents that I had. You know, I had a list, like most people who are pitching books have a list. And this time the reaction was just instant. And it was a positive one. And the first literary agent who responded to me just immediately was the agent that I have now, this wonderful, wonderful woman called Kevin Lyon, who is not only my agent, but my friend. And she represents a host of wonderful historical fiction authors. We even have a little group called the Lionesses. It's almost like we have where we get together online and we talk about our ups and downs, and there's some wonderful writers who are part of that group. And that's where it kind of all began. So that first book was Summer in France, and I had very low expectations for it. I had worked in the book industry. I knew how hard it was to go anywhere with your debut novel. It's a really uphill road. Mm-hmm. And getting attention, just even getting something published is, you know, you're beating the odds. Getting an agent, you're beating the odds. But then for the book to do well, again, it's not very typical without wanting to depress people about the chances of success as a writer. I mean, it's hard. It's a tough and often unforgiving industry. And I was just very, very fortunate that Somewhere in France came out just at the point where people were looking for the Downton Abbey fans, among others, were looking for books that would kind of feed their interest in that period. And it very unexpectedly became a hit and is still going strong. And I think is into its 20th printing now. And my editor, we called the little book that could, because it, no one had any expectations. I was just hoping that maybe a few thousand people beyond my actual relatives would buy a copy. And so that, you know, and every book I've written since, I've written six novels and one novella now, and they all turn on the history of pretty much the first half of the 20th century. And they're all caught up in some ways with the history of the First World War or the Second World War, and not just what happens during the wars, but the aftermath. I find what happens after a war is a tremendously interesting topic, picking up the pieces of all these shattered lives and finding a way to be hopeful about the future. And I have to say, this year of all years, this idea of picking up the pieces after earth-shattering events and finding a way forward is a topic that it just seems, you know, unfortunately very relevant. And every time I sit down to write, I'm reminded, I just see so many parallels in what's happening in the world today with what happened, you know, 50, 100 years ago. And the historian in me is constantly fascinated by the way, you know, the French, there's the French expression, plus ça change. And it really does feel that, you know, life keeps repeating itself in terrible ways, but also good ways, because, you know, when you see when you see the way people reacted during World War II and how brave they were, and not brave in big, spectacular Hollywood ways, but brave in that enduring and just getting on with things and facing up to what needs to be faced. I find that very, very inspiring.
Okay, great. I happen to know that you and I share something in common. And as you've mentioned, you also worked as a book editor. So before we really get into this week's topic, I'm curious, how did you separate the writing side of your brain from that editor side? Because I know I struggle with it. And even authors struggle with trying to edit relentlessly as they write. So I'm interested to hear about it.
To tell you the truth, I do edit as I write. It's just inborn in me. And I suspect my version of a first draft is closer to a lot of other people's versions of a third draft because I'm obsessive. It's kind of a pride thing. I don't want to turn into something that's really messy to my editor. And so, I write, my first drafts, I never share with anyone because they're so messy and hopeless and just mortifying. And I typically revise as I go in the course of a day, which goes against a lot of kind of received wisdom and how you should write, but it works for me.
That's what matters, right? It's what works for you. And you have to kind of work in your own process. So this week's topic is all about writing accurate but entertaining historical fiction. Before we dive into the topic in more detail, I'm curious to learn, why did you decide, you said you had a background in history, but why did you decide to write historical rather than, say, romance? What was the appeal for you?
I think it's just because that's what I read. I've always loved historical fiction. That's what I'm interested in. And history is the thing that really just sets my brain on fire. And I like reading. I like reading everything. The only genre I don't read is horror. And that's not because I disapprove of it or think it's terrible. It's just I'm one of these people that if I read a horror book, I'll have nightmares. So that's kind of off the shelf. But everything else is game. But what interests me in terms of what I want to write about personally is historical fiction. And I can't imagine I'll ever fully embrace another genre. My last book, The Gown, there's one thread that's contemporary, and that was a lot of fun to write, but my heart is with historical fiction.
Well, I personally agree with you, and I know I love a good historical read, so much so that I even thought at one point I would write in that genre. But although I love the manuscript I wrote personally, it was a lot of work, especially with regard to the research. So talk to me about how you go about, I know some of it may come naturally to you as a historian, but how do you approach research for each book and what is that process like for you?
I think I conform to how most historians would approach a book. And it's basically, imagine almost that you're an archaeologist and you're digging down layer by layer. And there's a lot of information to begin with. And I call that's the kind of the general survey stage where I'm just getting the general idea of what a period and place was like. Mm-hmm. And then the more I dig down, the more specific it gets. So I go from general histories to then what you'd call specialist histories. You just say a history of fashion, a history of food in a period. And then you're going each layer down, what you're looking for is the direct voice of the person who lived in the past. Mm. So with the kind of the gold that you hit at the bottom is first person narratives. So it's either memoirs, it's taped interviews. If you're writing about a period where, oral histories are common, it's even things like art, in the sense that it's somebody's point of view distilled through the medium of photography or painting, for example, and things like novels that are written at a time that were contemporary novels at a time and are now to us set in the past. Right. Those are tremendously useful. So all of those come to bear, and I do a lot of research. It's just a habit I picked up. I don't feel comfortable skimming. I go deep on everything, and it's a case quite often of my editor saying, Jen, just stop. And you have to start writing this book.
Good. Leave it alone.
Yeah, just it's enough. And yeah. then I'll start. But I keep researching even as I'm writing, because there's always little tiny holes that I have to fill in.
I bet. Okay, well, we have to take just a really quick break to hear from our sponsor, and then we're going to come back and dive a little bit deeper into this topic. So hang in with me. All right, confession time, folks. I got a bit behind this past couple months of 2020 on, well, frankly, everything. And I totally dropped the ball on coordinating with sponsors for the second season of the podcast. We have some secured for later episodes, but until then, I thought I'd take a moment and shamelessly plug my online writing course, which I mentioned earlier in the episode, How to Write Your Best Book. I created this course almost a year ago, and it took me, 3 months of staying up until 2 or 3 in the morning, sleeping a few hours, waking up, and repeating to completely put this course together for you guys. So I'm super proud and maybe a bit biased, but I truly believe this is the perfect writing course for any author who wants to write a great book but doesn't know where to even begin. This course is filled with 12-ish hours of content jam-packed with every single piece of writing advice, every tip, and every trick I typically only share with my author coaching clients. It walks you through the process of writing a book, and by the way, in any genre, from landing on that perfect story idea all the way through the writing process and even how to self-publish and a bit of marketing too. Listen, guys, I'll go ahead and tell you, I did some snooping before I first launched this course last February, and I checked out all my competitors' courses, all of them. Granted, a few of them are way bigger influencers than I'll probably ever be. But I have to tell you, there was something missing in each of their courses. Either they were too narrowed down on just one specific writing topic, or there were a couple I found that were supposedly beginning to end writing courses. Well, I'll just say this, they were boring. So I made sure when I created How to Write Your Best Book, I filled it with tons of pretty slides, some video content, and I also attached some downloadable resources to almost all of the 22 lessons that are divided up over 3 sections. And those 3 sections are: before you write, while you write, and after you write. And all this usually sells for me for $297, hundreds of dollars less than most writing courses. But guess what? I've decided to offer all my podcast listeners and no one else this exclusive one-time discounted rate for anyone who signs up for this course using the link that's in your show notes. Or you can visit our website under Author Resources, find the course, and click that. If you hop on over there before the end of February 2021, I will knock 20% off your entire course fee. I want you to go, seriously, go, and try to find a full-length course on writing a novel, beginning to end, taught by an experienced writing instructor like me, that A, has the same amount of content, and B, sells for anything less than $500. Guys, you have to go grab this course now, because at midnight at the end of February 2021, I am taking this course down so I can revamp it, update it, and relaunch it later this year. So hurry, hurry, hurry. All right, enough shameless promotion. Let's get back to my discussion with author Jennifer Robson. Okay, so we're back in the studio with Jennifer, and we are going to wrap up our conversation and dive a little bit deeper first on how to write accurate but entertaining historical fiction. So Jennifer, at least one of your books, Our Darkest Night, is inspired by true events. Let's talk about that for a sec. How do you approach writing a work of fiction that is based on things that really happened? Are there certain, quote, rules that an author needs to follow or issues to be mindful of?
So every writer of historical fiction is going to be a little different this way. What I do is I set my books against what I think of as a framework or a scaffolding of events that are broadly speaking known and verifiable. And then I insert my fictitious characters into that world. I do often have characters who are real historical figures who make appearances. So, for example, in The Gown, there are walk-on appearances by Princess Elizabeth, who's now the Queen, Norman Hartnell, who designed the dress, people like that. But that's always conforming to what is known about them. So if I put a real figure into one of my books, not only does it have to be possible in the sense that the person who is appearing in a scene, that I know that they were in that place at that certain time and that it was actually physically possible for them to have been there, but also it needs to be plausible. So are there actions in that scene in keeping with what we know of them as a person? Does it make sense, broadly speaking, against a historical background? And I think even if you're basing a book upon a known historical figure, most novelists who write historical fiction will use those two questions as kind of the arbiters of how to make it not only believable but entertaining. So is it possible that these things happen? But also, is it plausible? Does it make sense? Because ultimately, I truly believe readers are smart. Readers are smart, and they will know if you're playing fast and loose with history, and they will know if it just feels wrong. Even if they can't put a finger on why, they'll know. And then you're doing them a disservice. I do my best to present my best interpretation of the history there is, and to make it as entertaining as possible so people want to learn more.
Interesting. So I've always wondered, because the only time, like I said, I attempted to write historical fiction, I went with the wife of Caligula. So there was no history. There was a line in history about her. Well, his fourth wife. But so I've always been interested in learning, hearing how you would handle that. So thanks for sharing that. So I learned early on in my writing career that, and even in my editing career, that historical fiction requires some level of world building, just like fantasy, because you have to transport readers to a different time and often a different place. Do you agree with this? And if so, how do you approach this in your books?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what you call world building, I think of as setting the scene, and the backdrop has to be as convincing as the characters themselves. And it's all those details of life in the past that we may not realize how much things have changed until we read a scene in a book that talks about what people are eating for breakfast, for example, or how they got dressed. Or what they did for fun. And you don't have to make these huge info dumps. In fact, the less info dumping, the better. I mean, keep the details, not to a minimum, but it has they have to be organic to the scene. But it really is, I think, one of the most enjoyable parts of reading a work of historical fiction is to get a sense not just of the people we're encountering, but the actual world in which they lived. And that's something I spend a lot of time making sure the details are right. Especially with technology, if there's a piece of
Oh, yeah.
technology, it has to work within the medium of the time. And technology, even just ordinary household inventions. In my newest book, Our Darkest Night, there's a scene early on where the heroine makes coffee. It seems like such a simple thing. And coffee was very scarce, but she's been given just a small amount of coffee just to make a couple of cups of espresso. And just figuring out what kind of coffee makers that ordinary Italians were using in the early 1940s, I mean, that would took me a day because it wasn't the expected little stovetop mocha maker that a lot of people think of. It was another type of machine that's since been superseded. And that was, but it was worth it because now the scene feels authentic.
I would have even had to have researched if there was even such thing as espresso back then. So that's great. I love it. Yeah, that is so true. Because you, like you said, on one of your last couple of answers, readers are smart, and maybe not every single one will pick up on everything, but they will. They'll pick up on inaccuracies, and they'll, and not only that, some people love to write really picky, nasty reviews sometimes.
Oh, yes. Yes. And I mean,
they will not hesitate to tell you.
Most people are lovely, and I get so many wonderful emails. But if I make a mistake, someone will tell me. And I would much rather get emails saying, wow, you really nailed it, Jen. This is wonderful. As opposed to, you're terrible. You're stupid. And so that's, it's fear as much as anything else that animates me when I'm making sure that things are correct.
I agree with that. All right. So also, regardless of what area that your historical novel is set in, odds are your character's way of speaking will be somewhat different than if you were writing a contemporary novel. So how should an author approach dialogue in a way that properly reflects the chosen time, but is also easy for the reader to actually like read and understand?
Mm-hmm. I think restraint is absolutely key. So the first thing you want to avoid is anachronisms, right? Expressions that just were not used at mm-hmm. a certain time. And it really, a little bit of time spent researching the etymology of words and when they first came into common usage is very helpful. But trying to absolutely recreate speech patterns, especially the farther back you go, I find it's very tiresome when somebody is trying to recreate speech patterns from, say, you know, the medieval period and bending over backwards, because it makes it unreadable. So there's a fine balance between making it understandable and enjoyable to read, and also ensuring some level of historical accuracy. I think if you're writing about anything in the 20th century, the key is to actually read as much as you can novels that are set at, that were written at the time. So as I say, these contemporary novels, because that will give you a sense of speech patterns of the time. And then also films and radio, anything that depicts people speaking from the time in the time that you're writing about is enormously helpful. And you just, after a while, you just get an ear for it. You know, it's something, again, I have the benefit of training as an historian and years sitting in archives and interviewing people who were alive at the time. And so that helps. But, you know, less is more, I will say. And just check yourself for those anachronisms, because that's what will pull people out. It's not so much the patterns of speech. It's, for example, hearing someone use the phrase, okay, in a book that's set in the Civil War, right? That the word okay did not exist then, for example.
That's a very common thing in my editing career and even coaching. Like, that's something I see quite often when, not even have to be like set back that far, but even 20 years ago, you have to watch, you know, the, like you said, the anachronisms, the things that you say, have your character saying. And it's easy to do because we think that way. Mm-hmm. So I totally get it. And that is definitely something that we should watch out for. So quite often I'm asked by clients and followers how to handle real life people, places, or events when writing fiction. And I know that your books often feature stories based on real people's lives. What are the guidelines to follow so that we don't offend anyone, misrepresent anything, or even risk legal action against mm-hmm. us? It has happened, and I know people it's happened to.
Oh, yeah. And when I worked as a journalist, I took a number of courses in terms of, you know, how to avoid writing anything that was actionable. Mm-hmm. I operate on just the spirit of ethics, a feeling of, would the children or grandchildren of the person I'm writing about, would it hurt their feelings to see this person portrayed in such a fashion? Would the person be unfamiliar to them? Now, if the person you're writing about is an actual terrible human being, right? All bets are off. Like Adolf Hitler, I mean, he should be exactly as awful as we all know him to be. If you're writing about Adolf Hitler, let's put it that way. Someone like, for example, Norman Hartnell was the renowned designer who worked for the Queen Mother and the Queen for many, many years, designed mm-hmm. very important gowns for them. And is a secondary character in my book. The gown. Now, everything I read about Mr. Hartnell, his own biography, but descriptions of him by other people, he was mentioned in any number of memoirs. He comes across as a thoroughly lovely, decent human being. And quite at odds with what we might think of as a fashion designer, you know, who sometimes fashion designers have a reputation of being somewhat difficult or temperamental. Yeah, he was not. He was not that person. And then when I actually talked to women who worked for him, they agreed. They said he really was lovely. So I suppose I could have chosen to make him a difficult, temperamental, real pain in the book. But that, I just felt that that would have been morally wrong. Yeah. I would have just been turning him into this villain to serve my own purposes. And it also would have been factually incorrect. The man was, by every account I have read of him, a thoroughly nice person. So manufacturing some kind of villainy to suit my own purposes would have been wrong. I mean, if he actually had been a terrible human being, and I had verifiable information, then I would have depicted him that way, but he wasn't. And so, you know, that the question is, I think a lot of it is use your gut.
Yeah. Right?
If you know someone to have been terrible, then you can write them that way. You know, if somebody's, and you know, just as a legal principle, if somebody's reputation is already so terrible, because they're known to have committed terrible deeds. Nothing you write about them can be considered actionable because their reputation has already been thoroughly discredited. Mm-hmm. It's where you take somebody who, you know, who has lived a blameless life and then turn them into a villain that you could get yourself into trouble. And I just think, why put that out there? I write books that seek to inform and to entertain. And I think, you know, hewing as closely as I can to known characterizations of real people is just the best and the best route for me. But also, I just think, just in a general, putting out into the universe what I'd like to get back.
Yeah, that's true. Well, it has been just a pleasure to sit and talk with you today. And I hate that we have to wrap it up, but we do. But finally, before we do, tell my listeners how they can find you, find your books, and if you want them to, follow you online.
Certainly. So my website is jennifer-robson.com. Okay. You can find me on Instagram and Facebook at author Jennifer Robson. I'll be touring virtually for my new book, which comes out on January 5th, called Our Darkest Night. I'll be doing everything from my home office, but I'll be doing a lot of events. So there'll be ways for people to catch up. And if they have any desire to ask me questions, there'll be Q&As at most of those online events that my publisher is holding.
That's great. Well, we'll also include those handles and show notes, or the links in our show notes, so that people can access them. All right. Well, thank you so much, Jennifer. It's been a joy. And I really enjoy getting to meet you virtually anyway and do this conversation. So thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Okay. That was even more fun than I thought it would be. I've secretly always wanted to write historical fiction, confession time. In fact, I actually have finished 3 manuscripts that will likely never see the light of day. So it was really interesting for me to have this opportunity to sit down and speak with such a lovely, talented author and answer questions I know that a lot of you have. As the season progresses, we'll continue tackling questions that you may have, as well as struggles that you face as authors every day. And each week, I'll bring on a successful, well-known author to give us all advice on how to overcome these obstacles, learn from the mistakes, and one day find our own level of success. Please be a dear and show your love and appreciation to Jennifer. Follow her on her social media accounts that she listed. Visit her website to learn more about her published books and those to come in the future. We authors just have to support one another, right?
Right.
Okay, that's all the time we have for this week's episode, folks. I have to hop off here and get to work on all those really cool secret projects I told you about at the top of the show, or rather didn't tell you about. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and leave us a rating and an honest review. And in the meantime, go write your best book. This is what you've been